Three, two, one. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a hot minute since we have had an episode, but welcome back to the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. We are still out here trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement biomechanics and what it means to move and live in a human body. Today, we are joined by one of the most requested guests for this podcast so far. We are joined by Joel Smith, the founder of Just Fly Sports. He's an athletic trainer. He has one of the most popular recommended podcasts when people reach out to me asking, hey, I love your podcast. What do you recommend for other similar podcasts? The Just Fly Performance podcast with now over 385 episodes is what I recommend to other people because it's chock full of incredible interviews, amazing information, great perspectives. And without going too long into the bio, the biographical description of you, Joel, I'd love to jump right into a conversation about movement, about training, and get a broad overview of what you're about straight from your mouth. So in terms of training, in terms of movement, in terms of what you're working on yourself and your own practice and your practice with your athletes that you work with, I'd love to hear what you're up to. And just thank you, first of all, for being on the show with us.
Yeah, Anthony and William, thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation, I guess, in a nutshell, or right, like the elevator pitch, just to keep it that kind of brief, and then we can expand from there, is my athletic career. So I'm 40 now, and I've been training or interested in training since I drug weights up to my room when I was 12, and I was doing wall sits when I was 10 or 11 to try to jump higher. So like trying to do things, movement things better, has always been something that's been near and dear to my heart. But I would say through my 20s, being a track and field coach, university strength coach, and the transition really was in really my 30s, I guess you could say. Early on, I approached the whole strength equation from more the traditional piece of it's sets and reps and exercises and do these three drills and try to hit these positions when you do these three drills. And if you look at you could say one term would be the masculine and feminine, or just more of the science and the art. There's a lot of ways to say it, but I definitely started coming a little bit more from just more of the science, more of the structure. And as I've gone throughout my career, and especially being able to work with a pretty broad scope of athletes, all the way from swimming Olympians to track and field to coaching 5 and 6 year olds playing soccer and pretty much everything in between, you see the things that kind of go between the cracks of just having a basic, hey, do 3 sets of 10, do these A skips to sprint faster and put your limbs in these positions. You get out of, get out of the 2D, and you start to look at the actions that happen in between those spaces that are, the popular posts on Instagram. Hey, do these two things. You start to look at all the actions in between. And so it's been the spaces in between that have really been my peak interest in my late 20s, 30s, and up till now. The podcast I run has done nothing but fuel that, because every week I have a guest and I can ask them all the questions I have about those things. I've also had the good fortune of having some extremely good mentors in the movement space that really, every journey, or you could say hero's journey, you have those archetypes, those people who teach you. And I've had some very powerful figures in my life, had good opportunity there. I wouldn't be the coach or athlete or human I am today without them. So that was a 150 floor elevator pitch. So sorry that took a little bit long, but that's kind of where I've gone. More track and field too. My roots, basketball, track and field, a little bit of break dancing in high school. I'm actually realizing that dance kinesthetics is in my blood more than I've realized as well in my own training journey, and how that impacts how I coach others. And also how I understand where other coaches might come from and how they approach movement. So throw that in there too as I get off the elevator here.
Cool, man. And so one of the things that I love you said right there was this idea of the things that happen between the positions, the movements that happen. And one of the things that Will says a lot of the times, the Instagram posts, he calls it the one move explosive guy, where you do these drills, these power drills, where you're starting here and then you end there. And it's kind of like, yes, there is no attention to the nuance of how you're getting from point A to point B necessarily. Let's just do it as explosively as possible. So when you were looking at, okay, we're doing these positions, we're doing these movements, but there's, maybe this three-dimensional reality or this multi-dimensional reality that happens in movement, in athletics, what point did you realize that it's like you had to start paying more attention to that? Where did you notice that there was the gaps? What was the thing that kind of cued you into the fact that things were being slipped through the cracks? What inspired you to look into it?
Yeah. Well, I think the first one was this ever growing irritation in my own like brain spirit, or you could even say just this because of my track coaching days. You have, and track is like, you know, outputs combined with movement. You have, ultimately, you want to run the fastest time, jump as far as you can, and there's all this movement on the way there. And in sprints, it was a very easy catalyst because sprinting is probably, it's very, in some ways, with respect to like a javelin throw or a pole vault, a sprint is an easier movement to watch. It's cyclical, so you can see the same thing happening over and over again. And so it's easier to train your brain on what's happening in that respect. I think that's part of actually, you know, our obsession with speed and linear speed, which I think is cool, but it's like, it's just a nice window. It's a nice catalyst to see a lot of these things in action. And I would watch sprinters and we'd go through the sprint drills and I'd go through all the typical coaching. Like you said, the power guy, you know, hey, get to this position, knees up, lift your toe up, do that position. And then you watch them race. And they're not doing any of that. But it was beyond my understanding. It was like, you know, you live in these series of, you could say, bubbles. And if you're in one bubble and you don't have the understanding of what lies beyond, you just kind of get confused. And then you have the options. One, you could just go back to giving the same old coaching cues and just hope they work. And I think there's nothing that's not terribly wrong, by the way. I think that there's value in some of those things, even from a general perspective. And athletes can self-organize and get better. But I think knowing that I was seeing things that I didn't understand just kind of irritated me because I'm obsessive with wanting to know everything about what's going on with these movements. And so the fact that just in watching sprinting, especially like a lot of the rotations, the stuff in the transverse or rotational planes, like you would see the sprinter from the front view. And just for example, people may have seen this and you'll see people whose feet are like, and knees are like out to the side. And I'm like, wait, isn't everything supposed to be in a straight line? How's this guy fast? How's he not breaking and getting hurt? You know, those kind of questions would pop up because no one was talking about that. And so that kind of in my system for a long time. And then I met a Darian Barr one day, who is a track and movement coach out of California. I met him because I was finishing my first book. It was actually my second paper book or print book called Speed Strength. And in writing that book, it was going to be all about the strength and power that goes into working with like sprinters, track athletes, or even just running a better 40-yard dash, anything with linear speed. How do you prepare for it physically? When I wrote that book, I wrote the first chapter that I'm like, all right, well, I should write some mechanics. I should do something mechanical. And this is me having 6 years of experience coaching Division III track, being a track athlete. And I'm writing, you know, 9 chapters of the book is power training, basically, and 1 is technique. And it's just funny because as I'm writing that technical chapter, I have a bunch of these books behind me on my shelf. You probably only can see a couple of them, but I went through every major book that had been recommended. And even within those books, I was not finding the answers to the burning questions I had as a track coach. And it was when I met Darian finally, I'd seen some of his stuff on YouTube. It was actually kind of hard to understand him beforehand. And so I never really pursued it, but I knew he was in the area. So when I'm writing this book, I'm like, I have to, if there's something I don't know, I want to know it. So this guy clearly knows something I don't. So I met him in person to coach. He was working with a long jumper that day. And just from square one, I was like, this guy, there's something about this guy. He sees the world differently. He sees the next bubble. I only understood 1/5 of what he even said. It was like a different language a little bit. The long jumper he was working with obviously knew. He'd been working with him for some time. And that's almost the thing too, is like sometimes there's almost a literacy that goes with a lot of these things that I think we just not only understand it from a intellectual perspective, but we also learn to feel it. And so it was through working with him that I started to slowly grow my understanding of some of those rotations I didn't understand and things I didn't see and know. And beyond that, I actually had the good fortune to spend a lot of time in the swimming world. I grew up sucking at swimming, to say the least. I was horrible. Like I failed my level 3 swim lesson. I couldn't do like the butterfly. Like there's all this, and then it just kind of soured me. Maybe I had heavy bones too. I don't know. But in working with swimming was amazing because the medium of water is not only does it prioritize even more ability to process the world three-dimensionally, because you have to do these twists and turns with sensory feedback. You run, your hands could swing in the air and you could get nothing. I know David Weck has the pulsers or propulsors, which are amazing because that gives that sensory feedback. But the nature of the water, you also get it. And I think swimming and swim coaching has evolved to a more sensory level than a lot of other movement practices. And then I spent time with a swim coach who talked about manufactured swimmers. He would point out swimmers and I would see like their hand seeking a pre-planned position before they even touch the water. Basically kind of the equivalent of, hey, the power guy, right? Lift your knee up, lift your toe up. And then you start to go to meets and you'd see people doing that. And you'd see a lot of people who are very like intellectual types. The coach told me this, so I got to do this. But then you'd see the best athletes, like the fish, the people who would get in the ocean and play, and they weren't like that. And they had this intuitive feel. And so it really challenged my thought process on how we learn skills, who the best athletes are, and then how to navigate that world. That coach who taught me about the positions also liked to use the ocean. He liked to use the ocean to get people to swim reactively and to be able to innately, intuitively process their surroundings. So I've been able to slowly take these things on in my own journey and kind of like having that base of more traditional, you know, thought processes and traditional strength and power. And then I've been baking in and building in more of that, those things that go between the cracks. So maybe a little, another, I'm sorry, I went on longer there than I meant to, apologize, but
no, yeah. that was great. Actually. It sounds like a lot like me. I'm 40, former athlete. I didn't come from, track or any formal athletics, but I went through the academic end of things. I learned theories, came to my chiropractic practice and my own, personal movement practice. And there was holes. I did like the theory and my application didn't match up, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually heard about David Weck, I think maybe from your podcast, one of the first 100 episodes possibly, maybe 5 years ago,
yeah,
right? So thank you for that, by the way, because that led me on a whole movement journey. And basically now I kind of want to get into the thick of things where you talk about looking straight on a sprinter. And in the academic world, it's mostly side view assessment. That's what I see from almost everybody, right? But I went on your channel and I went on your Instagram and I see you talking about the coils and I see you talking about spirals and rotations. My question is, how do you see the spirals and rotations happen? Are you looking from a certain position in the body? Are you looking at the whole system? Are you looking starting at the foot, starting at the spine? How do you view rotations and spirals, let's say in a sprint or a run?
Yeah. So we can just talk about the front view, for example. So if you're watching it, and this could be a track sprinter. If you go on my Instagram, I have probably every like eighth post or 10th is like a Safa Powell and Usain Bolt coming out of the blocks from the front view. That's a really good one. If you are, for the listeners, just trying to find very easy things to go run to and check this out. But, It's Bolt, Powell, Stockholm. You YouTube that and go to about 150 in the video and you got these guys coming at you from a front view. Awesome place to see these rotations happening, because so often you would think, and this was one of the things that Darian had mentioned very early, is like a wall drill is a very common drill to learn sprint acceleration, where you're holding a fence or a wall and leaning it 45 degrees and then maybe switching your legs in space. And there's not to say there's not value in that. I think there's a certain level of value that can be transferred. But ultimately, when you do that, you lock into the sagittal plane. It eliminates a good portion of the side to side. And so what I'm going to be looking at there is, one, everyone's going to be a little bit different too. So base of support is definitely a thing. So someone who naturally squats with their feet a little bit wider, that's just their preference. They're going to have a wider base of support. So that would be like in the biomechanics, compression, expansion sphere of things, that would be people who have a wide infrasternal angle. Everything just kind of ends up wider, like even like the pubic bone and the nature of that, things are just wider on them and their base of support is wider. And what's interesting is if you actually walk that way, so you can get in your own body and feel what that feels like. To me, that's very important in coaching these things, because I think we tend to coach so much on a visual level where we're so used to only video. It's only, and again, that's the world we live in. But you can feel what it's like to be those guys if you're a narrow base of support person like I am, but by actually walking a little bit more, almost like on the outsides of your feet, and you feel what it's like to have to rotate around that a little bit. And I'm not saying like turn your toes in and don't get to the inside edge of your foot ever. I'm just saying when you start to do that, you feel how these people manage their acceleration. So there is that base of support piece. Like Christian Coleman is the world record holder in the indoor 60 meter dash. He's run equivalent to a 4.12 40. he's a little bit more of a wide base of support guy if you watch him squat. And those rotations come to him very, very easily, and I think that's just part of his nature. There's also the skill side of that too. So like with Usain Bolt, what I'm looking for, and let's just say, you would see this too in like Mbappe, Erling Haaland, like football, soccer players, you're going to see it like just even like when they're standing and they're really, they dig in and take their first few steps, you see this. I'll speak to this in layers too. Like the first layers are the ones that are very easy to see and understand. And the first layer would just simply be head over foot, because that's only one position in space. It is an action, but it's a very, David does a great job, Weck, of coming up with phrases that are very easy to see, understand, and process. So the first layer would just simply be that, watching the nature of the head. And I actually really like the rib cage, because you would never see an athlete do this really like naturally. Like in sport, no one's going to throw their head to the side wildly and the rib cage stays in the middle. If you told someone, hey, I really want you to throw your head, and you wouldn't say throw your head over your foot, but it is possible that if you use that term head over foot, that the head actually may travel further than the rib cage, if that makes sense. So you always want the head and the rib cage moving together. And most people would do that just fine. But I also look at like the head. The head's the easy marker to see, but the rib cage should be going right along with it. So marker one, layer one, is as the person is traveling forward, is that rib cage traveling along to meet the width of the foot. Now in acceleration, it's going to be wider than top end speed. So there's good research to show that in track and field, and you see this in team sport as well, is that good accelerators are going to have a wider, even people who have a naturally narrow base, like an Usain Bolt is a naturally narrow base of support. He has a narrow ISA. As Alex Effer says, narrows are just narrow all the way up the chain. So Usain Bolt, narrow, but he is skilled enough that he still has that side-to-side width. Like if you had a ruler and he comes out of the blocks and his first step hits and then his second step hits, the width of those two, not the length front to back, but the side-to-side width, that will be, it's not going to be like 4 inches. It's not like he's, or six, it's not like he's standing there. It's going to be at least like 10, 12, 14. So, but as he starts to get faster and faster, then it will narrow up. And then it's almost like he's sprinting on a line basically. But the thing about acceleration is that acceleration exaggerates everything. It slows things down a little bit because the step length is slower. And everything gets a little bit wider. And so it really plays into the full 3D nature of movement. And so the head and rib over foot would be layer one. Layer two is you're going to start to get a little bit into the transverse plane and internal and external rotation of the feet, the legs. And so that's like that. Now that becomes more of an action where it's, you could track the position of the head and rib cage a little more easily. So as that first step comes out, so the swing leg coming forward, and it's like, you know, talking through these, I'm always, I've tried to be very methodical when I explain this, because I've had people on my own podcast talking about biomechanical pieces, and I get lost so fast if there's not a visual. So if you need me to reiterate anything, please let me know. But
no, I think we're good so far.
Okay, awesome.
Good stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. So layer two. So, and again, I would say too, for people just learning this, spend a lot of time in layer one. Watch layer one without even worrying about layer two for weeks, months, if you want. You know, and I think because it's where we all start. That's where if I look at myself at an earlier age, that's the great place to start. It's just easy to process. But then, yeah, once you can move into that layer two, how is this impacting layer two? Because if I'm accelerating and I get a big head over foot shift and a lateral stride width, well, what naturally now needs to happen is the hips will turn a little bit to do that. And when the hips turn, it's going to fling my front swing leg. So that you think your coach, you were learning, you accelerate, and the coach said, drive your knee ahead of you really hard. Well, you kind of do. But in that drive, you actually are also internally rotating the knee. So if you think, all right, I'm going to push off and sprint, and my right leg's in front, and I'm swinging my left knee up in front of me, in that first step, in addition to your knee coming forward, you're also going to rotate, your left foot is going to rotate out towards the side a little bit, and your left knee is going to rotate in towards the midline a little bit. So that's that internal rotation that's happening. And that's coupling with actually external rotation, or a little bit of an external rotation bias, in the foot that's pushing off the ground. So you almost think of it like Chubby Checker doing the twist. Like I used to see this in like NFL combine athletes. This was another thing I would always see. I'm like, I don't get this. Like you'd watch an NFL combine sprinter, or just an athlete doing a 40. Their first step, they're, it looks like they're Chubby Checker doing a twist. Like their arms as a unit are biasing, twisting to the left, and their legs as a unit are biasing, twisting to the right. So it's like this along the transverse plane. It's like you're combining head over foot with the twist, the Chubby Checker twist. So layer one, head over foot, layer two, Chubby Checker twist. And I think that actually makes the action, to me, this is my frame of how I see the coiling action, the Joel Smith's version, inspired and really helped by David Weck's work over the years, 100%. But I see it as those two actions combined. And it's those combinations that cause a fluid coil. And ultimately, if it's in your body, the next step is now feel that how your body's timing that up. And when you're timing it up, it should actually feel the same thing as when you're running with the pulsers in your hand, you know, or something that's vibrating and shaking, because your body should be doing this in a way that if it's too much intellect and there's too much extra coaching and you're trying to hit a position, the timing won't be there. Like if you're running with a pulser in your hand or two, or the vest, I'm excited, you know, for when that comes out. It would be very difficult to hit the position your coach told you, because the timing innate in that shaking device would want to bring it back to center. Your body wants to stay, keep everything timed up and running in an ever continuing series of spirals. So that's actually one of those things that can teach people very well. And so, yeah, just to reiterate, layer one is watch the head over foot rib cage. Layer two is watch the Chubby Checker. And the internal and external rotations that come with it. There's also internal and external rotations in the arms, but that's going to get without a video that, I mean, I'm even going to get confused without a video trying to put all that together. And then three is just the timing that binds all that together and watching like the timing of the limbs in space and how that feels for the individual. And the thing is though, this is always the humbling thing, is that good athletes already do all that. So, and that's just like where you go back to square one, you know, people. And then of course, as a coach, you find most athletes have something here or there that they need to work on. Or if you have an athlete who's already really good at it and they just want to sprint faster, well, hey, we'll just emphasize this part of those three today. Well, let's work with this tool today and let's really build out that part a little bit more, you know, and not even just work from the 2D straight ahead, but I'll give them maybe a rotational challenge and work from that perspective. So I hope that clarifies things well. Let me know if you guys have any questions with that or thoughts.
I think the way that you described it is really, really clear. And there's a couple of things that you've talked about throughout the conversation so far that I kind of wanted to tie together. One was this idea of reflexive movement when you were talking about swimming and that sort of, you know, they're trying to get that hand position before they even touch the water. And sometimes I noticed when I first started getting into gait biomechanics, I was really influenced by things like David Weck and the head over foot and the Goda movement system that has these, you know, these very specific positions that they try to get you into. And what I noticed was that I kind of became neurotic in trying to hit these positions while I was running, and it wasn't a reflexive action for me. And so that was part of my evolution, was actually taking a step back away from just pure positional training and positional awareness and learning to create a reflexive trust in my body to be able to handle some of these positions, while also trying to figure out, well, how do I train these things without becoming neurotic when you're talking about the timing and the sequencing, I guess, of how this stuff is supposed to fire. How do you train this when you're talking about giving your athletes a rotational challenge, or you're maybe breaking down the sequencing a little bit? How do you avoid that issue of it becoming a neurotic thing where you're overthinking? How do you make it reflexive while still also training the qualities and the patterns of trying to improve these athletes?
Yeah. So for that one, actually, I'm going to give you a little bit of a story on a bandwidth of things. And so on one end, we would have like a lot of let's just think common movements, throwing, sprinting, swinging, any typical explosive sport movement. A lot of times those come with each of their own position. If we take this all the way across the spectrum into just distance running, distance running is a beautiful place to become completely attuned to no position. And I say that in the sense that sometimes there'll be track and field coaches who have a sprints background or speed coaches, and they're tasked with helping distance runners. How do they go to help those distance runners? They give them all the sprint drills. They give them all the positions. But then, of course, you watch those runners, and it's going to all instantly fall apart. Not instantly, but, like, I mean, they might do it to make the coach happy. They might want to try something new. Oh, cool, I'm working these muscles, lifting my knee. And that's fine from a general strength perspective. That's fine. You go and do a 5K, guess what's going to happen 800 meters into that run if you're trying to run with a high knee toe-up action or any sort of mechanical motion? It's going to get very inefficient. It's going to fall apart. And so I've had the good fortune to work with distance runners from a technical perspective. So especially athletes who are working for like military, special forces, 4 mile run tests, mile and a half run tests. To me, that's been one of the more enjoyable things that I've been able to do. And so in working with them, I find that we start not with any real position. We start with basically, I'll try to make it three things. Hopefully in my head, I'm like, okay, three things. But we do, one is body awareness and relaxation. So, and I talked about this, I was on a podcast with Austin Yoakam, and I was talking about, we just have this obsession with activating everything. What if we just deactivated stuff that needs to get turned off? Because most of us have neurotic holding patterns of some sort, you know, that messes with our movement. If you look at human beings compared to animals, the ultimate movers, you know, I talked about the elite athlete who could put all those layers of the movement pyramid together. Athletes or animals do that too. And I believe one of the things animals have on us is they don't carry their neuroses the way that we do. I watch like people running around my block and I'm like, man, like just really like, I mean, some people are pretty fluid, but a lot of people are like really short, choppy, very like stressed or intellectual looking, you know, and, or plotty. And I think that just in running itself and the disinhibition of holding patterns, you can actually make running a really cool experience. So we'll start by just, I mean, we just do basic mobility. We do spinal twists and rotations and neck circles and all that. But I'll have them run after and say, hey, feel that, what you just did. Feel how loose, much more loose that joint is when you're running. And so just trying to integrate it within. It's nothing that's really that complicated, but a lot of times you watch people run and you see the holding patterns. And so, and I'll just do mobility and then intersperse that with running to try to slowly shake those out. But then what we do is we get into breathing and rhythm. I won't get into breathing so much because that's almost more, for me, I use that actually as a rhythm piece. Like, hey, breathe. You're going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 strides, inhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 strides, exhale, like just to teach and work with rhythm and running. And it actually takes your mind out of what should I be doing with my hands? And some people, when they get that breakthrough and they nose breathe, I've seen just the jets go on. It's just crazy. Anyways, for rhythm though, this was like a light bulb moment. So I've had the good fortune, and actually I have to credit Jeff Nichols for this. I head to his, runs a, like a tactical performance in Virginia Beach, and he's had me in to work with the groups that come train there. And so this is a big opportunity for me to only work distance technique. And so to get into that piece, and there was one day, and my routine for these guys was going through awareness. And then I had them, like the Kenyans in the Kenyan running system, they start with rhythm. Like they do a step rhythm class. Like that's their base, is they have like, they got music on, everyone's like doing step rhythm stuff. And if you watch Kenyans run, probably like Ethiopians or anyone in that area, you see two guys running side by side and you see them going step by step by step together. And that's the rhythm piece, is they can do that together. And so that was a drill I had the guys doing. We also had pulsers on hand. And I had the guys working in groups and matching each other's rhythm. And then Jeff mentioned, well, why don't we get the pulsers in and match rhythm? So as soon as we start going in groups, running with pulsers, you just hear this shake, 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 but it's like everyone together. And I swear everyone's times on this about half mile loop drop like 10 seconds with no more effort, just instantly. It was just crazy. So like we have this awareness piece, releasing tension, find a buddy, find the rhythm with them. And so instead of, you could say top down is like instructional, bottom up is feeling first. Distance running has to be bottom up. There is no top down, because as soon as you go top down, any little slice of inefficiency, any slice of overthinking is going to kill you. And you know, I've seen like in track and field, 100 meter runner, like you can get away with some manufactured stuff for 100. What tends to happen is those people tend to not be very good 200. The wheels will fall off a little bit more for them in the 200 meter sprint, but people can make stuff work for a short time if they have the movement options. So that's where I've found a lot of value in the distance piece. So for someone who does come from an overthinking background, and I use this a lot, is a lot of times when I work with a client for the first time, I'll actually just have them skip because when you just have an adult skip, you see all the pre-programming, because a lot of times it's like, all right, wait, what did my coach in high school tell me to do? He told me to put my hand like this. And you also, you see all the holding patterns. You see a lot of even like rotation or coiling through the rib cage. Do you have a frontal plane? Do you not? Are you trying to think too much? Do you have a sense of rhythm? And so a lot of times I will start with those things. So disinhibition, rhythm, working with rhythm. I use music a lot. I love music. Anything that's got to be, I mean, you could do a boring metronome too. There's distance coaches who will use metronomes. I prefer apps like a Rock My Run is a really good, I plug them. They don't pay me anything, but I love them. It's like an $8 a month app that has like a playlist, and the whole playlist is strung together like 130 beats per minute, you know, 140. So if you want to hit that 730 mile pace, you know, maybe you're at, you know, 130 or something like that. You want to drop it to 5:30, you go up to 165, you know, and you can, and but that will carry you, and it keeps you. I mentioned the last thing I'll say here is I mentioned the timing. I mentioned that is that third layer of the pyramid. When you have music, when you have something, even a pulsar, you have these more rhythmic things, even your breath. It just helps timing. It just helps that continual everything being on point to the, you know, few milliseconds it needs to be. And that can be very helpful too. So some, those are some of the first places I go in those situations.
That's very interesting stuff. The rhythm timing coordination is something I constantly talk about, but I'm more into martial arts and three-dimensional movement. Do you work with any athletes outside of running and sprinting and track?
Yeah.
Where you're doing more three-dimensional movements?
Yeah. So I work with, I would say that the athletes that I work with in person, is actually not track. Track okay. is mostly online. So I do a lot of online training and performance, a lot of masters track people, professional track athletes. And so track is more online, a little bit in person, but in person, it's like volleyball. Like a lot of people are like volleyball, sand volleyball, a little bit of like soccer and those types of things. So it really is pretty distributed.
Did you lose them?
And when I
did,
was
just for a second.
Yeah, so did I.
And we're back.
Yeah,
I think.
Sorry, we lost you for about 15 seconds
I lost you at sand volleyball.
Yeah.
Okay, I could start again. Yeah, I could talk. I could just start again talking with who I train, if that works.
Sure.
Well, I'm going to build on top of that question just because basically, how would you train rhythm, timing, coordination outside of track? Because the reason I ask is that I do the same thing, but I do it in working spirals, kind of like David Weck's ropes. I do dual ropes and I match it with footwork that I do from boxing. And then I try to do it in three dimensions. That's just an example, right? I do it with dance, that sort of thing. Is there anything that you would add on to that, or are we on the same train with that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, in working with different athletes, so a lot of people I train are in the track and field space, work with individual sports like swimming. So a lot of that is that cyclic locomotor. But in working with different team sport athletes, you know, that is something that I think a lot of what I've done with that has been more in the perceptual space, like think games, think like parkour derivatives, think you know, small-sided games, stuff that would involve like, hey, dodge this dowel rod in a bunch of different ways. I would say in hearing what you were saying, that, you know, that martial arts theme, I haven't actually spent a lot of time working in like the fight and martial arts world, but that makes perfect sense with that. And so, you know, that to me, I think that, let me just say this is I've actually just, and I don't know if this post will get released anytime in the near future, probably soon, but there's a lot of people who argue about like Olympic lifting, like, oh, is Olympic lifting bad or good or whatever, you know? I think it's just a tool. All these things are tools. And I have this like quadrant in my head. It's like on one end you have in the vertical axes, you have is skillfulness. So skillfulness, touch, like just that fine sense of like, you know, almost like a dance ability. On the other axis, you have forcefulness, raw power and output. And each sport is almost a different combination of those qualities. Some take a lot of both. Like you could say a sport like golf is very high on the skillfulness, but you can get away with not being extremely forceful. And you could actually say if you're too forceful, it could actually impact your skill a little bit. Like the long driver, maybe all that time just being forceful on the long drive and hurt their short game a little bit, you know, or like you could even look at like a like a Steph Curry in basketball. I mean, yeah, he can jump, but he's not like the most powerful guy on the court. And so it's like there's these different or even like Erling Haaland, like people, he's a more forceful soccer player, just a freak athlete. And he's not, you know, he doesn't quite have the touch of a Maradona or something like that. But so I look at it a little bit in those perspectives. And I think that some of that touch timing piece could fit with that really skillful. And you think about what a fighter intuitively feels and needs. That makes a lot of sense to me. That's the thing that I have only done a very low level of boxing training. I would have loved to do jiu-jitsu, but I watch you do that and I could see that as something a fighter feels, but I don't have the experience myself that where I felt gotcha. That and would go through, but it makes sense to me for sure.
Anthony,
does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, it's a great answer actually. Yeah. Everyone has different experiences within that realm, right? Like, since I'm more into the martial arts and the movement, I put it towards that. But if you're more experienced with the running, you're going to get the same rhythm, timing, coordination piece there.
Yeah.
I think coordination, rhythm, and timing are one of the least, the things I see that talked about the least or practiced the least. And I don't think a lot of people believe you can actually practice that. I think it's more just like, work strength in the gym and then go to your sport and you'll get it there. That's where you get those pieces. But I do think you can train them outside of that and then go into a sport or life. So yeah, it's very interesting.
I'd love to talk a little bit about this idea of like the Olympic lifting thing and just lifting as a tool in general, because our niche audience, it's kind of like a joke. It's like the niche alternative biomechanics space, right? The functional fitness crowd that has, you know, some very polarizing, contrasting opinions about how you should train and how the body is meant to move and this sort of thing. One of the popular narratives within this niche audience that we love so much is, you know, is lifting good for you or is it bad for you? Does lifting decondition your patterning because you're overly specializing in, you know, these movements in the sagittal and frontal planes? Are there negative implications to the joints? And for, I would say the pervasive narrative for a long time, for at least the first 100 episodes that we were doing, was the consensus with a lot of the guests that we had on was that lifting came with fundamental drawbacks. We did a lot of episodes about the potential fundamental drawbacks on movement quality in terms of over specializing in lifting. And now what I'm kind of noticing, I like to keep my finger on the pulse of the community conversation, right? And what I'm seeing the community starting to talk about a little bit more, at least on the fringes, it's kind of like whispers of it. It's like, actually, I don't think lifting is inherently bad. I think that we're just jumping to it too soon and you're not addressing movement quality first and you don't have these fundamental baselines. And if you build some of these fundamental baseline qualities of movement quality first and joint organization first, and you have your structure, then you can actually use, you know, positive pressurization of lifting. And this could actually be a very, very positive thing and you don't have to sacrifice movement quality. I would love to get your take on A, do you think that there are negative implications to over-relying on what we call linear lifting or Olympic lifting, just as an example? Are there negative implications to movement quality, gait mechanics? And then conversely, could you use these tools more effectively if you build some baseline structural stuff first? And if so, what would those be? I know it's like a lot of questions in one question, but
I love it. No, I appreciate that because I've had guests on my own podcast ask me multiple times. That was like three questions. I'm like, I'm sorry. I just want to know a lot of things. So I get it. Let me start by, this is just more philosophical, is there was a good article I had read about maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago on, this is just general thinking is, and I can just leave it to just a few areas, but sometimes we can think of just thinking and we could extrapolate this to the fitness industry and weightlifting as the conformist train and the contrarian train. And you could very easily say, well, the conformist train is just lift as heavy as you can. It's going to help you be a better athlete. And the contrarian train is lifting sucks. Don't do it. Do all these other, you know, functional movements over here. But at the end of the day, the ultimate place that's good to be is to be able to take a nuanced opinion in the midst of both conformist and contrarian thinking. Because what can happen is if you're just a pure contrarian, you could end up as extreme as the guy on the other side. You could end up as extreme as the ultimate conformist. And so with that in mind, you know, and just a story that goes with that is I had the, I'll call it the honor of training, of being taught by Gary Marinovich in Monterey, California. I was down there. Matt Cooper, who's down in LA, invited me. He was going to hang out with Gary. And so the Marinovich system, just background, that is the ultimate contrarian system because Gary is like, hated weightlifting. If you talk to him about weightlifting, and Gary is like buff and intimidating. He looks like Jack Santa Claus, and he was like 80. I mean, this guy was in insane shape. And so the Marinovich training system was characterized by a lot of like balanced disc type work, like a hard balanced disc or work on a physio ball that's done extremely explosively. And this isn't like, hey, just balance. It's always active, chaotic. It's very demanding. And the way that Gary would coach it was very demanding. I mean, he was like intense. Like usually a lot of times we might associate things that are in the more balanced sphere with things that are a little bit more, I don't like not intense like powerlifting, but Gary would coach this intensively. And Gary told me a story of a lot of like NFL players would go train with Gary. And this was in a fighting gym as well, though. Like he trained people out of a fighting, like an MMA gym. He told me a story of an NFL guy who called him, who I guess hadn't been moving very well, like in the game. And he's like, hey, Gary, I squat 500 pounds. And Gary's like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. So, I mean, it's, but what I've also heard, though, is so Troy Polamalu was an NFL player who trained with Marv Marinovich and doing all these things. And apparently he was, Polamalu was like a poster boy for the success of that system, like not lifting weights, getting explosiveness through like supercats and machines and all these other alternative systems. But apparently I had heard that Troy was actually sneaking off on the side to lift weights when Marv didn't know or something about it. So like, I mean, it's just a bunch of arm curls. I don't really know. But all I'm saying is I think that each of these things is going to have its breaking point. And I've been through those breaking points. Like in the sense that when you first start lifting weights, you're taking what's probably a more or less functional body, because most people, when they start lifting, maybe they start in high school, middle school. Hopefully they've had a youth that's rich in movement, like different sports, all sorts of things where you have a body that's a more functional level. And then you put a little bit of lifting on that, and hopefully it's a decently dosed lifting, and you will see some basic improvements for sure, for the most part, in many cases. But the question is how long are those gains and it going to keep coming in for you? How long before you start, you could say, move like a refrigerator, or something is happening that's not going to be ideal. And what I found is it does depend a little bit on the athlete and the sport. So people who are more, you could call them like a kangaroo, a narrow infrasternal angle, like a Usain Bolt, or like I'm trying to think of like a basketball, like just trying to think of a good example. Victor Wembanyama, like, there you go. That guy 100% is a narrow. I mean, as narrow as it gets, probably like 7'5", like super skinny, like anything like that, or like a Ja Morant type. Those types are going to generally, the more you lift and compress them, they will shape change more quickly. They have a window where they want to be very explosive and rapid in their movements. And if you compress them where they have to grind through squats and things, and deadlifts, the more they grind through movements, it just doesn't generally go super well for their movement patterning. So over time, you'll start to see, I've seen degradation in movement quality over time. People who are more like a wide infrasternal angle, so like even like LeBron James is probably a little bit more in the middle or wide, but like a Christian Coleman in track, you can think like a football, think of like a lineman in football, something like that. Those people are built to be compressed more. They can handle it more. And so a lot of it ultimately is the structure of the person. And then also, in addition to their structure, like a sturdy person, like who's built like a gorilla, can handle sturdy things. And I think we just can't forget that they can. And that's when I was at Cal, I had just come off of a time spent coaching track at Wilmington College where I overlifted people and saw the degradation of elastic athletes through overlifting. And then I'm going to Cal with this in my back pocket, like trying to keep everybody from overlifting. And I just found there was just some athletes there who just needed to lift heavier. Like you could even just say it was mental for them too. But I found when I finally gave them, you could even call it a drug of heavy lifting, because it's a full body experience. They liked it. That was something that was actually helpful for that group. It wasn't everybody. And then also I think the skill force, if you have that quadrant, skill and force, like a shot putter, like Joe Kovacs, who has the number two shot put in history and beat the 1990s drug record recently. There's a video of that guy squatting 800 pounds for four or something deep, like the beast. That guy probably needs to fulfill his gorilla nature to do what he does. But then again, the further you get more into the skill realm, like just think like tennis, soccer, martial arts, like things that are very prioritized on having touch, skill, recognition, perception of the environment. I think it can start to lose how important it is. And that's why I think you get people who, I'm trying to think of, this is like a total mind blank. I just know in MMA, it's been a big debate. Like, should you lift weights? Should you not? Like the Marinovich based system. I cannot remember Nick's last name in LA, trains a bunch of fighters in LA. They don't lift, like kind of follow that system. I think the more you live in that skill-based world in the upper left of the quadrant where forcefulness is not the defining factor, I don't think you have to, you know, and people just kind of argue about it a lot, but I think it just depends on where you are on the quadrant and then where on the quadrant you are in relation to your body shape. You know, can your body shape, even mentality too? I think some people just mentally want to do it more, and I think that's okay. But I've gone through it all. I've overlifted, compressed myself, did powerlifting programs, and my vertical just went downhill horribly. And I'm a narrow person, so I'm going to be influenced by that. And so that, you know, I have Olympic lifting in a lot of my programming. You know, the power lifts is something I've kind of modulated a little bit more. Like I tend to not like 5-3-1 is a very common powerlifting program, very one rep max, heavier loads driven. I just think within the lifting that athletes do, I tend to cater more towards higher reps, 1x20 sometimes, but sometimes it's just something that sits in more of a 3x5 to 3x10 realm, just to keep it simple. I just think that for people who do sit on the forceful side of the quadrant for the most part, and we're doing that stuff, I just won't press them with heavy loads. And they'll just try to make it as efficient as possible. Even if it's one set of 10, do one set of 10, you know? So that's kind of where I've fallen. My mind also, I will say too, my mind works in a way that drives me nuts sometimes. Is it's very expansive. It's like it's constantly throwing everything out there that could be every possibility. And so it's like, it's hard to take that possibility to be like, well, still do one set of 10 to make sure that's in, you know, like always trying to rein in the possibilities in the program. So I think other people who could be more definitive in a smaller amount of pieces in a program could have a very easy time also eliminating some of those things. So I like to have a lot of things in my program though, in a reasonable volume, of course.
Yeah. So that was very comprehensive. Great, great answer. I wanted to shift more towards, you were mentioning elasticity. And how I actually noticed you have a course on it, and harnessing elasticity is one of my obsessions right now on how to move. So I have my own take on it, and I would very much love to hear your take on how you see it. And do you take connective tissue and fascia into account when you're theorizing it or in application? How are you actually devising the exercises? Can you give us a little insight on that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really great point where we are starting to see that shortcoming of just the weightlifting, just the one rep max mentality. And so what else contributes to human motion? And I think at first, you know, kind of with like the contrarian thing, I think it can be easy to be like right off the offset. All right, well, muscles, don't worry about muscles. It's all about the fascia. Well, it's like, well, it's kind of everything, you know, it's muscle, pressure, fascia, levers, you know, nervous system. There's multiple contributors, but certainly the elastic return, like, and I think I saw in one of your social media, it was like a baseball player throwing like a submarine throw. Yeah. And that is just insane because it reminds me of, yeah, with like the fascial piece. And I've heard of the fascial piece as like a bridge, like a bridge with a suspension arms and ropes, or a dinosaur's neck is a good one. Like a long, like a brachiosaurus, like a really, really, like it's got a 30-foot long neck. And that dinosaur neck could not support itself with only the bones and muscles. There has to be some sort of tensegrity oriented tissue that's actually creating a holistic suspension system. And when I watch that baseball player throw, I'm like, man, like that is not possible without some sort of more integrated piece to it. So with that piece in the equation of a baseball player as like an anchor, like, cause I think people could picture like a high velocity, slow motion, like 100-mile-an-hour throw. So much of that load with the elasticity is levers. And that's something I really took on from a Adarian Barr. And so with levers, things that are typically trained in the gym are more of what Adarian would refer to as a class one lever. It's like a seesaw, like a squat. You're kind of compressing yourself like an accordion, versus speed levers are things like that baseball arm. They're swinging limbs in space. So you think of the foot a shin swinging around in a sprint. You think of that forearm swinging in space in the throw. Those are speed levers. And what I find is that elasticity is very much gained by a mastery and an intentional training of those levers. And so, well, the question is, how do you do that? Well, very easy. In one perspective, it's, well, just go sprint. and so even like the base of the pyramid. Okay. Long sprints is something that I've been fascinated with for a while in the realm of, let's just say locomotor stuff, sprinting, even jumping. So sprinting, jumping, and you could even take that into multilateral sport movement to a degree, probably is going to start to lose transfer, like in a really hard cut or something like that. But what I've found, and I'm certainly not the only one, but track and field jumps coaches for a long time prescribed, and this would be counterintuitive, right? Why would you have a high jumper run 8x200 meters sprinting on a track if they're just going to do one jump over the bar? That's kind of silly. But in reality, it's repeated cyclic locomotion that's prioritizing. I mean, think about the travel of a foot in a sprint. It's going to go kind of high up to the level of the hips, hopefully not like way above and behind it where you're like flinging the foot too far, but it's going to go high up towards the level of the hips and then head on a collision course down to the ground. It's like a big wheel and it's whipping around in a way that doesn't happen. It's like you could think of just spinning a rock. You have a rope and a sling and you're spinning a rock around your head. That's like a class 3 lever. And so that foot is spinning around with high velocity and then is being subjected to collisions. So that is a loading parameter that goes far outside the weight room because most things in the weight room are more accordion. So it's like you have your accordion in the weight room and then you have your swinging levers outside of it. And so that's why I think like things like, even you look at, speaking of the swinging rope, things like functional patterns, I think that's why that is, that to me seems to be a cornerstone. Think about swinging a mace, swinging anything in the air, that now your body has to operate on a little bit different system. And so running is very much that way. And you can take that in many different directions. So different modulations of running, different surfaces, skipping, and different motions there. So that's and that's a very simple way to go about doing it. And then another thing too that goes along with that is, well, what is the sensory interface between the foot and the ground? Well, it's the feet, obviously. And so it's also then trying to find ways to help athletes get sensation in their foot, make sure that they can control the foot better. And again, this is where high repetition comes in, because a lot of times we will look at muscles in the weight room as 3x10. Once we get to more of those swinging limbs in space that are subjected to collisions, that's something that doesn't really get trained by 3x10. That's like, that could be 3x100. And that's where you, it's not slow twitch, it's just velocity collisions. And that's how the elastic tissue gets trained. It takes more reps. It takes more effort. And it also, there's also, like you mentioned, there's the timing that brings all of that together. So, I mean, something, one of the things that's my favorite elastic workout in a perspective, and there's many ways to do this, but one of the things that I always felt was so helpful was the first time in running track, you get on that track in spikes and you run a few hundreds in track spikes. Just that feeling of pop that you have, because it's like your forefoot is so prioritized and it's like, it's cyclical. It's over and over and over again. Maybe you're taking 50 strides for 100 meters or something. I think Bolt was down at, I'm not sure, it's like 43 or something like that. So you're more than that, but you're getting in the hundreds of steps. It's not 3x10 and it's like that rock spinning around. So that would be a basic way to put it, but I just like things that are ballistic in nature and really making a priority to incorporate and utilize those. And like you said, the swinging rope, like swinging the rope around, that's like a low-level ballistic, low-level fascial, just kind of like, maybe that's even almost the, depending on how heavy it is. I know there's like the light ropes I'll see, that's almost the regenerative version. And then you can escalate that all the way up into the heavier mace bell swings and things like that. But I think also at the same time, if we watch just children playing, learning, throwing, jumping, running around barefoot, there's so much of that that exists in that medium as well. And so it's very quickly within reach of all of us, but I think it is helpful to put like, okay, here's an exercise, here's a category, here's a way to get a little bit more of that.
Now, with that in mind, I feel like conventional strength and conditioning is a little bit easier to track quantifiable progress, mm-hmm. because you have, yes, the sets and reps, you have the periodization, you can be like, oh, I have all these very clearly defined variables, the weight's going up or the performance is going up, their velocity's going up, whatever it happens to be. But I find with some of this, you know, with the rhythm and the timing and the elasticity, quantifiable measures in progress are a little bit less tangible. And how do you know that you're making progress, or how do you plan for gradual progression? Because I feel like it's not a progressive overload situation, yeah. Right? It's not like a load management thing. So when you're tracking progress, how do you know that what you're doing is working for your clients in terms of improving elasticity or timing or things like that nature? And how do you progress that quadrant, I guess, of training?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think that's one of one of the reasons amongst many that, and I think weightlifting is good, but another reason it's popular is that you go in and you start bench pressing. Well, hey, wow, in a month, my bench press went up 15 pounds. I am strong. It's so easy to see and feel, and it's so tangible. And I think that's great, but it is a little bit harder to notice that. And, you know, I mentioned like the actions in between at the beginning of this podcast. Some of the fascial elastic type thing is some of those, it's just feeling better. It's feeling more fluid. Honestly, from the perspective of a strength coach that works with teams, it's lower injury rates. And I say that with a slight grain of salt, because there can be a level of arrogance with, oh, my team doesn't get injuries, and being able to predict all injuries, they are multifactorial. But just that being said, I have definitively noticed switching to a more, you call it elastic, getting away from the heavy barbell lifts in my populations, that has had a very positive correlation with miss time in games and things like that. So it has been beneficial. But I'll just say too, like, okay, tangible. I live in the track world a little bit. So my easy examples are things in track. Before I give something like that, I will just say, just if we're talking about like the feet or even like a mace, we can talk about that too. But from the feet, a good place to start. And if people ask me questions sometimes that are very generalized in plyometrics, and I know they have room to explore. Like if people are giving me I try to answer everyone who gives me like a message in a DM or something like that. And if we talk about pyramid level one, hey, go do 5 minutes of calf jumps. Can you do it with only taking like a couple short breaks? I mean, it can start as simple as that, only because I think sometimes to stand out, we need to give a very nuanced and complicated answer. But in reality, just do 5 minutes of calf jumps. You know, it's kind of like jumping rope, but it's almost just more intentional, because it's just, you're just jumping up off the ground, maybe 2-3 inches every jump. You're lifting your toes up a little bit every jump. I mean, you can take dorsiflexing pogos into positional. And that's something where I wouldn't really, I don't think it's going to kill you, but I don't do that philosophically. Yeah. But the calf jump, lifting the toes up, is more about getting tibialis on the way up a little bit, calves on the way down. Just adds a little bit of pop into it. And I think it's fine there. So can you do that with minimal breaks, maybe only 2 or 3 for 5 minutes without your feet and calves absolutely being on fire? Can you do 50 three-way standing hip circles without needing to take breaks and falling over? A three-way hip circle, just think basically standing on one leg, spinning your other leg around in front of you to your side and to your back, and the whole sequence for 50 takes people about maybe like 2.5-3 minutes a side. So it is actually something where I've seen it, when I go to groups and I have people do that 50, almost no one can do it. And that just can indicate a serious lack of basic qualities to be able to do those kind of things. So can you hop there? Can you do those hip circles? And then you could say from an upper body perspective, can you swing a 10 or 15 pound mace for 5 minutes straight without feeling like you're dying? Because that is not just shoulder muscle. It's also the ability to manage it. And there's something about that from an elastic element for the upper body as well. So those are places that I would start, just from like the gym. Hey, we're doing this in the gym. But if we get out on the track, and this is something that I wouldn't have caught myself really doing this, let's say 5 or 10 years ago, but I've gotten into it a little bit and I like it. And I think too, because the poles can swing so hard, like, oh, conditioning's bad, it's stupid, don't do distance running if you want to be explosive. I like having people run at 800 before they start their workout. Just run a half mile. Now, yes, endurance is a huge part of that, but efficiency and elasticity is also a massive part. I mean, I can tell you, when I was in high school and played basketball, I didn't do distance running or conditioning. I played basketball and did sprints and hurdles, but I could go whip out at 800 easy, because I just bounced along the whole thing and it was effortless. You know, I mean, I didn't run like the fastest time in the whole world, but it was quick. And I noticed the difference dramatically. Like if you asked me in the peak of my powerlifting days, which were not that impressive, to go out and run that 800, it would suck. Like I'd be at 400 and it would already be brutal, and it wouldn't be just the aerobic. It would just be everything. It would be the elastic management, the feet, every piece of the human machinery would be that. And that's also something too, are some of these tests, if the test becomes too complex, it loses the humanity. The best stuff is the most simple. You can just go do it. And so, you know, if you want to see a combination of your elastic and aerobic, go run an 800. And the last thing, I'll just cap it off, that just reminds me, I'm starting to see more and more people who are doing these, like the hybrid athlete, right? You do powerlifting and you do running. And I just think it's just that, like you asked me about lifting, I respect the hell out of someone who can squat 500 pounds and then go run under a 6 minute mile. And I don't think you would necessarily need to tell that person stop lifting, because, well, they're demonstrating an elastic proficiency in their running. You could not run that five, whatever it is, or around that mile if you didn't have a basic level of elastic proficiency. So I do think that it could be that simple. It's just the question becomes on the level of each individual athlete, what specifically might be holding you back and how can we really dig into that in a way that fits you the best. So I'll just, yeah, leave it simple there. It's a great place to start.
Yeah, I think so too. I remember, do you know who Alex Viada is?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's I remember asking him on Instagram, because I, for context, I think he pulled 800 in a powerlifting meet and then the next day ran like a 50 mile race. So this guy is an absolute beast. And I remember asking him, it's like, do you have any concerns about the training in your powerlifting affecting your gait mechanics? And he said, look, if you're running as much as I am, you're doing far more repetitions of steps and running than you are doing repetitions of lifting. And so he said it wasn't even a concern. One of the ideas that Will and I have talked about in previous episodes is the idea of like just the raw neural output associated with lifting. Like when you're lifting closer to a one rep max, or you have that higher intensity where you have to focus in on that technique and that sequencing, it has a high neural input in your system. And so the sequencing part is always the thing that's fascinated me the most, right? Because when you're the sequencing of firing muscles in a deadlift is somewhat different than the sequencing of firing muscles in the rotary actions of, say, running, in my opinion, right? And so this is something that I've just been like observing and playing with and questioning and wondering. One of the things that I did notice, I found it really interesting. I did stop lifting for about like a year and a half, 2 years. And I focused on functional training and training specifically, still resistance training, but doing some more functional pattern stuff, working with the Parabar, doing MoveMed stuff that, kind of orients around co-contractions and learning basically to sequence my muscles and to self-organize my body in a more efficient way. And what was interesting is my trap bar deadlift went up by 50 pounds. Mm. That was my one rep max, and I did it for two. You know, so my one rep max prior was like 455, and then I did 445, and then I did a 495 for two reps, which was like, I didn't get it. I didn't understand because I hadn't lifted in 2 years. You know, I just like picked up. I was like, holy shit, that's pretty cool. But the sequencing thing is always fascinating to me because, you know, there is a high neurological output of a squat. And I do remember that, like, the same thing that you were talking about, I came from a bit of a powerlifting background too. Like I was very overweight as a kid. The way that I lost 100 pounds was through lifting and through, you know, eating a healthy diet while lifting. And trying to run was the most excruciating thing in the world. Like, forget 400 meters even. Like I couldn't even like get halfway around the block without feeling like my joints were exploding and my lungs were on fire just because of the sheer inefficiency of it. Right now I'm doing like nothing impressive, but at like 190 pounds, I'm, you know, hitting 5Ks pretty, you know, a couple times a week and feeling like it's like, holy shit, I never thought in a million years that I could even run a 5K. It's kind of crazy. And it's just working this sequencing and this efficiency. So I'm always fascinated by this idea of like, you know, what do the neural inputs, how do they train our body, how to move to, and again, it's the idea of the reflexive thing, right? Like these high neural inputs from lifting are teaching our body to handle stress in a reflexive way in a particular sense. And then, so when we're in these situations where we're trying to just not think about what we're doing and just go out and run, it's like, how much of that is going to impact us? So that's just something that like, has often, you know, I've wondered about a lot, but the more that I'm just like living it and experiencing it, the more I realize it's like, you can do both, but you have to be pretty honest about like, when are you, I like that you use overlifting. Overlifting is that you're the first person that I've ever heard use that term, where it's like, instead of like lifting is bad, it's like, well, no, there's actually a point of diminishing return. So maybe just look at where this tool is no longer serving you, or this tool is actually starting to, you know, diminish in returns, and adjust accordingly to that. So it's not a question. I just wanted to throw some input in there.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, and I like that. Yeah, what you mentioned, what Alex said too, like if he's running thousands of steps, what's going to be the greater stimulus that your body ultimately adapts to? And I think there's just something that's really potent there. The one thing I think about that as well is I heard Paul Check say this at some point that always kind of stuck with me. And I don't know if this is 100%, like it's a zero or 100 thing, but it's that your body adapts to the most stressful thing you did. So I do think that, you know, there also can be a weight that's carried. Like if you do a crushing, you know, if you're grinding out like a one rep max heavy squat, you know, all the time, there's things that your body has to kind of adapt to not die. So I think that's worth, you know, that's worth throwing in there. But I definitely agree with that, the vibe of that as well. And I also found too, the further I got away from playing team sports, the more a lifting program did start to negatively impact me because I wasn't doing those other things. And I just think that can't be understated, the importance of having a multilateral athleticism outside of just the lifting program you're doing to feel good. And like you said, Anthony, it made you stronger. I felt that the same, like my best strength to body weight ratios have generally been when my track jumps have been the best. and not even like the other times where I focus more on powerlifting outside of that multilateral dynamic program, my strength to body weight actually wasn't that terribly impressive. So it was like that total functional unit that's neurologically charged up and ready to go that can plug itself into other things as well. I think that is, you mentioned, I think at the beginning of the show, like that one core unifying theory is that same thing that helped you to deadlift 495. You know, like that's the thing we're all chasing, I think, more so than, oh, well, the one lift or the one thing, you know, it's that total charge up of the body that it can function well and do those things.
And Will, I know you have a different experience with strength training in general. You haven't lifted at all a lot longer than I haven't lifted even. And, you know, a lot of your content on your page is asking the audience, like, would you consider this strength training, you know, like pulsing with a heavy rope or doing some of the isometrics? And, you know, I'd love to get your input on in terms of like, you know, how you're seeing strength in the context of this conversation.
Yeah. So to counterpoint what you guys were saying with Alex Viada, and I know there's a couple other long distance runners who are going for heavy lifts. I rarely see, if ever, I can't even think of an example, somebody who power lifted at a high degree and then went to running and was successful. But I see the opposite happening, right? So there is context there of like what you do first, because I do think you can be a runner, a long distance runner, and then stop doing that or stop competing in it and then get your numbers up in the gym through, I mean, just a few years of lifting, right? So I do think it goes one way and not the other. And I haven't seen a counter example there. And in terms of my own personal practice, it's more, I only have so much energy to put in and I want to maximize coordination. So it's a time thing, one. And I literally just don't have time to do the other thing. It's not a priority for me. So I feel like I can get quote unquote strength without going to the gym and actually doing the lifts by doing the things I'm doing outside of the gym. Now, is there a way for me to test it? Because again, it goes back to what is strength. So the average person on the street would be like, how much do you bench? How much do you squat? It's like, I don't know. Right. So I used to be able to squat quite a bit, like almost 500, but I wasn't athletic at that point. So there is an element of how much time do you have in a lot of the things we do, even functional range conditioning. I like a lot of what they do, but I just don't have time to dive into it. Right. So like I take
cars
what's
all day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. I take what's useful to me at the time. And then I kind of disregard the rest and maybe come back to it later at a different point in my life. Right. So that was just a little context on the conversation there. I did wanted to ask you, Joel, how do you see stability? Like if I was to say, because it's a word that to me is thrown around quite a bit. It's like, let's do stability, or standing on one leg is stable. What is stability to you?
Yeah.
Like if I was to say hip stability, let's say. Yeah,
that's a good one, because I think that's another thing where if you look at one and kind of the more traditional strength side of things, it's very much about force. So be forceful, be stable. And you could even look at it as this type of level is that not all, but many people who find themselves in, and this is in athletics, so not fitness, but athletics, is people who are the strength coaches in sport tend to be the people who probably didn't like the chaos of sport as much, because otherwise, well, wouldn't they be sport coaches? You know, like, sport is more chaotic, like people flying around the field and all sorts of, you know, emerging patterns and things to take, you know, there's a lot more chaos. There's a lot less chaos. It's more of an inner journey in the gym piece. And so I think that what kind of that can go into is it everything is very controlled, like control everything as much as possible. And so I have seen that in very much, you know, if you talk about like, I mean, like back health and stability, lock everything down. The spine shouldn't, you know, this shouldn't move at all. And I think that sometimes if your lens, so I think a lot of it depends on what your lens is your lens. If to me, my lens is very much like watching Usain Bolt start from the front view or watching Erling Haaland, and you see all 3D planes of motion and you see the body working using all three planes as it needs to in perfect timing. And it's very hard to look at that and say, wow, look at these things getting locked down. Like there's nothing getting locked down. So what, and Cal Dietz had said it really well, strength coaches and many people are familiar with, try to run a 40-yard dash with your abs braced. That's going to suck. Like it's not going to go well at all. And so, I mean, and actually I think that's kind of cool to try. Like I would invite anyone who loves stability and always talking about stability, go try to run as fast as you can with your abs braced. There's a piece in motor learning called magnifying the error. And for someone who's actually, you know, we talked about tension and relaxation, something that you could do to actually help people realize how tense they are. If someone's like face is real tense, say, hey, I want you to tense your face up a ton when you run, because then they're going to be even more aware of it. And then say, then the next rep, say, we'll just go do whatever now. And you'll notice that their resting facial features will actually be more natural and normal. So I think that in some ways, you know, and this is where I think this could almost apply to anything, not to get into a rabbit hole, but even what we would call bad, air quotes, coaching could sometimes be, if it's just for a couple reps, the athlete actually might be getting the error and then they go and self-organize something that's awesome, you know, and it actually happens a lot. So that being said, though, I think that I won't ever really say brace this, tense this, lock this. I'm much more of a, even it was a Pat Davidson seminar. Pat's a big guy in biomechanics, strength training, and lifting. And he said he'll never put it in a person's head in the corrective exercises he does what muscle to feel. He'll always ask them after the fact, because it goes the same thing as manufacturing. You don't want to manufacture the movement just to cheat and turn on a muscle. You want to do the movement well, and then hopefully the aftermath is that muscle felt worked. And so generally, the way that I see, when you tell someone to create stability for the most part, or force it, you're doing the same thing as in running when you tell someone to forcefully lift their knee, forcefully lift their toe, or that swimmer hitting their hand already is in the position their head thinks it should be before they hit the water. You are eliminating the timing. You're eliminating the dance, we can just say. You're eliminating that dance between the hand and the water and it finding the water tensioning and it knowing where to pull. As a good example, I think as soon as you're having someone do an exercise, you're like, all right, activate and brace this muscle. It's kind of doing the same thing, to be completely honest. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think you want to create constraints that, like if I'm having someone do three-way hip circles, if you do 50 standing three-way hip circles and you don't put the other foot down, your hip is going to be functionally better after that. You could say it's more stable. Sure, it's more stable, but it can handle and absorb and release forces better. And something that I think is, to me, a good, maybe another good way to look at it, and this was just said on my own podcast, is a body that has a little more relaxation to it is going to be able to absorb and redirect forces much better than a body that has a lot of tension to it. And you could try this too to see, like you could drop off a step and tense every muscle in your legs as hard as you could and then rebound up. And it would probably feel very like kind of pingy, but it wouldn't feel very fluid and you'd probably hit the ground real hard. Or you can drop off the step with relaxation and then see how high you can rebound. And you're going to rebound a whole lot higher because your body can have just a better utilization. Maybe a higher step would be better for that, like an 18-inch box or something in the gym. Next time, do that. Tense every muscle in your body as hard as you can. Drop off the box. See how high you can rebound upon hitting the ground versus having maybe you shake your hands out and shake your feet out on top of the box. Let things loosen up a little bit. Even when I've seen like David Weck do things like jumping with pulsers, I found I'll do this with RSI mats, which is a reactive strength index on a mat that tells you how quick and fast and high you jumped off the ground. Sometimes putting a pulser in your hand that actually is a relaxant of sorts. It's an athletic relaxant, I should say. Mm. It's not, you're not going to hit the ground like Jell-O, but that actually can increase the reactive strength index. And if something is increasing reactive strength indices, I'm tripping over my own words, it shows that you can absorb and release forces better. So wouldn't we want that for every joint in our body? So would we ever want to forcefully manufacture tension? Probably not. So my goal would always be, yes, you want to be stable, but the paradox is you don't get stability by telling the body to be stable. It's like you can't make someone love you, or, you know, for another, you know, kind of like you can't say, hey, love me, you know, like you can't force some things in life. And so you can't force, you have to set the conditions up for the body to make it or let it happen, and it will happen. And that's just part of the art of coaching. I think a lot of things is the body, as with anywhere else, is that you could try to rush or create, you force something to happen, but ultimately those things will happen on their own given the right circumstance.
Cool.
Yeah.
I really, really like that answer. And unfortunately, I'm kind of dealing with a bit of a time constraint here, but I love to ask questions like this when we're wrapping up. Practically, when it comes to what you're seeing a lot of people doing in their own training, what's something that you can see most people adding to their own training or their practice or their regimen that can enhance their relationship with their body? Or I really like your emphasis on reflexiveness and the sensory based things. What's a simple practice that you would add into what people are already doing? Or what do you think people are missing that they could start doing right away that could have a huge benefit for them practically? If they're like coming off this podcast and like, all right, I'm going to do that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it depends. You know, it depends how weird you want to get. So I'm going to throw something that's a little more on the far, if you like to polarize things, makes them simple. So on one end of things, we have like as much muscle tension as you can deadlift. Like that's on one end. So the other full polarity on the other side, as far as you can go, would be detensioning. And there's a really good video, is Marcelo Polozzo. I think he studied under Ido Portal a little bit. And I talked about this on a podcast with Austin Yoakum. I've been using this a lot because there's many ways to do this. But to me, this is one of the quickest, and it's also fun. And it kind of you have to be full send. Like you can't chicken out on this. But it's basically just shaking your body. Like you could YouTube Qigong shake. You could look up Marcelo Polozzo on Instagram. He has these videos where he's just shaking limbs. So I went through this practice with Aaron Cantor, who's one of Evolve Move Play, Rafe Kelly's company, his coaches. And his warm-up is just 5 minutes of just shaking. So just stand on the ground, even like just think like a half-inch calf jump at first. And whatever, if your chest is tight, let it go. If your neck's tight, let it go. Whatever muscles are tight, just go ahead and let it go. And Marcelo takes this even further into a whole body series, like hanging with the arm, like bent over and letting the shoulders like loosen up. And I was actually talking to a guy who's a pitching coach for the Detroit Tigers, I believe. And he was talking about on the off days, those players' off days, he takes them through that series. Like it's like we would talk about fast and loose, Dan, John, Pavel. Mm. So something like that, that just involves shaking, and where we've always been taught activate, 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 do, 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 this position, etc. Try doing the 100% opposite of that, and then just go do your skill and see how your body responds. And what I found is ever since I mentioned that on Austin's podcast, been doing it with every time I've programmed it for my athletes. They love it. I had a guy, I programmed it for him for like 10 minutes. He's like, I wanted to do that the whole workout. I said, fine, go ahead and do it the whole workout, you know, like do it. And then I had a guy too. He's like, man, I cut time off my sprint instantly doing that kind of thing. There's different protocols with that because again, you're just getting out of your own way. And it's also kind of like it's something that goes, you can't intellectualize it. You know, you can't, hey, what are these three drills that, you know, it's like you have to just, it's the opposite of everything else we've been taught. So doing something like that would challenge you either superset it with your running, superset it with your other movement practice, whatever it is, use it as a warm up, use it as an off day, do it to music, and then see what your movement quality is in the aftermath. I would challenge you to find some portion of that. Do it at Planet Fitness or whatever. So you'll be the next person on a video that someone takes for the random weird. Yeah. The weird guy at Planet Fitness. So
I love it.
Yeah.
Will, any other closing thoughts or last minute questions?
No, that was awesome. Thanks, Joel, for coming on. That was very enlightening. I'm sure our guests and the audience are going to love this one. So yeah. Absolutely. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Like, really, thank you so much. This was a really, really fun conversation. In terms of finding your work, I know that you have your website, just-fly-sports.com, where you sell courses. You can check out seminar dates. You have your podcast, which is an amazing podcast that I recommend everyone who's into this show go check out. On Instagram, you're at justflysports. Anywhere else that you want people to find your work?
Yeah, I think you did a great job covering it there. You reminded me of that hyphen in the main website. It's just brutal. But yeah, those are the places. So yeah, any of those will work great. And yeah, thank you guys so much for having me on, Anthony and Blim. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun talking to you guys as well.
Great. Thank you so much. And guys, if you don't mind, if you're watching this on YouTube, leave a little like, a little comment about what stood out for you most in this episode. It always really, really helps getting it out to more people. Share it with your friends, other movement geeks in your life. If you're listening on Spotify, leaving us a little review and answering the questions that we have is also really fun. We like to engage with you in the community. You can follow me on Instagram at anthony.manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E. And Will is at The Art of Move. He's the OG of the podcast, basically. So if you guys want to check us out, come have some community discussion. Tell us what you liked about this episode. Tell us what you didn't like about this episode. We're going to have a discussion either way, and we'll catch you on the next episode of The Art of Move.
Have a good one, guys.